question, can companies do good and do well? Do we want them to try even? The loudest voices in the room are the dirty industries that don't want their access to capital constrained in any way. Get your ESG out of my pension fund and these kinds of messages. That's them funding that. So there's no misunderstanding, right? And then, but then there's the common sense business people who are like, we're pro-capital and we're pro-investing and we like values. But in this case, if values and profit were to come into conflict, we want profit to win because that's how we see these vehicles. That's very, very fair. You're not going to change the minds of the folks that are funding the propaganda, the polluters. Where it's important to try to change minds is to say, hear ya, this works with, again, quote, no values required. This is structural. It doesn't depend on the niceness of the intentions of the founders or anybody else. This endures. This is a way of building companies. Just do this. You ought to be legitimately more interested in these kinds of investments than less.
Welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD, where successful San Diego leaders share their stories of leading beyond profit and are using the influence of business to powerfully change the companies and communities we all work and live in. I'm your host, Jeff Blanton, founder and CEO of Jailbreak Leadership. At Jailbreak Leadership, we unlock the power of AI by creating your AI strategy, streamline the technical and logistical implementation, and most importantly, guide the AI adoption of your team. We want to thank our collaborative community of business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Cause San Diego, and Be Local. We're all focused on impacting our community of San Diego through the work they do as business leaders. Welcome to the show. Today's guest established three goals early in his career. Love his work, work with smart people, and make a difference. As the co-founder and chief impact officer of Oyster, he has not only delivered on his goal for himself, but for thousands of others. Jack Mardak, welcome to Conscious Curiosity SD.
Thank you. Thank you. Impressively researched introduction, I must say.
I looked into you, man.
And more than that, you distilled the right things. Absolutely. And it's an awesome pleasure to be here with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm excited to have you here. In 2022, Oyster became notable for being one of only a handful of B Corp unicorns in the world, meaning it is a privately held startup company that reached a valuation of $1 billion while doing good in the world. This is so timely. Just last week, I moderated a panel that was asking the question, is it possible to run a successful business and do good at the same time? Jack, I think you've answered that question, yes. And I'm very excited to have you here today to explore how you made that happen and what's your thoughts about the future and bring all your wisdom to all our audience here. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. And that's a great tee up. You mentioned having recently been a part of a conversation that was asking the question, is it possible for companies, for for-profit companies, to do well and good? And by well, we mean make a lot of money for people and investors. And by good, we mean more than hand-waving, but demonstrable, evidence-based ways that the operation of that company is having a positive impact, right? As you rightly observe, this question is having a big moment right now. And that's happening for the convergence of sentiment from a variety of different directions. So, to start with consumers, just before this podcast looked up, because I wanted to have fresh data, recently collected evidence around the question, do people care? Do consumers care? Do they prefer companies that are doing good in the world? And the answer is, yeah, like 60% of millennials and Gen Zs say it matters to them. And so this is the future. They are the blossoming consumers of the next generation, so that matters more than our boomer or Gen X votes, although they're in there too, and I think they're also raising their hands to say that it matters, right? So this matters a lot. But part of that same research also showed that there is unprecedentedly high skepticism about these claims, and so it's like, yeah, but we are also smart enough now to realize it's just saying so.
Some good marketing going on.
Yeah, and has been for a long time.
Yes.
You know, for a lot of brands that are like dubious actors in the world at best, these companies are reaping what they have sown in these decades of deceptive, hand-wavy kind of marketing. So very, very important, nuanced observation from the young, which is it matters a lot, but like we're also really, really skeptical and we'll insist that you prove it is the takeaway.
To that point, one of the keys is the consumer has a lot to say in this whole equation, and we need to recognize we actually have the power.
Yeah, and always did, but like have been distracted, but that's changing. So the other important domain to look at for important signal is impact investors, right? And so this is the collective of investors who represent money that has been brought together specifically for the aim, trying to find those precious combinations of value creation and demonstrable impact in the world. This is decades in the happening. Whatever the greater ESG debate has been publicly waged, quietly in the background, this has been growing 20% CAGR since 2019 and is like $1.7 trillion. That's thousands of investors and many more dollars saying to the builders of the world, this money is here to support you in the attempt to try to do this thing that I often describe as mixing oil and water, which is to make a lot of money for investors, employees, et cetera, and build a scalable impact machine. So the investors are there. The other arena of activity is where I have been focusing, which is entrepreneurs who are interested in the idea, who are inspired by the combined problem of commercial success and impact in the world, but maybe don't know where to go, don't know how big the investor interest is. And so enter our example, which is Oyster B Corp Unicorn. Our model is to put a dent in economic inequality at a global scale by making it possible for people in those countries where, until a few years ago, they never dreamed of life-changing knowledge work jobs to now have those jobs. The solution there is to solve for global scale contracts and payroll, a long, hard problem recently solvable with software, which is what we built.
So I can join the company and not have to relocate to wherever they're at. I can stay where I'm at, the country I'm in.
Exactly, exactly. And so rinse, repeat, that puts a dent in other social problems like brain drain and loss of community for the people that leave, language, et cetera, strains on families. So, we proudly published an annual impact report at a very early stage, kind of one of those signals that I was keen to put out as both the head of marketing and the person that was really most caring about whether or not and how well we walked the walk to go with the talking of the talk. And so we've been publishing our data and showing our impact in the words of our stakeholders, those people whose lives have been changed by access to life-changing remote knowledge work. So we've been publishing that for several years, and it's one of the things that I think are a hallmark of any for-profit company, right, to sort of just have this separate narrative about impact in the world. I think for us it was a no-brainer. We were keen to publish it. I think it's something that should be an important available artifact that corporations of all sizes
get to do that.
take seriously. Yeah, and of course, in the best cases where there is impressive impact to show, those companies, I'm betting and investors are betting, are going to do disproportionately well in the market versus competitors.
And they have been. It's been measured for forever.
Right.
You know, one of the founders or one of the key players in this organization is Conscious Capitalism.
That's right.
And Tears of Endearment, Raj Asodia, was written a long time ago that basically went out and said, look, the guys that are doing this are doing way, way better than the guys that aren't doing this. But somehow that falls on deaf ears along the way.
Imagine that.
I want to share one thing I thought was like really cool the other evening. We had like almost 100 people here at the BBB for this event that I was just talking about, the opening of the show. And I kicked it off as the moderator said, I have a big question we need to answer tonight. Can you run a successful business and do good at the same time? And I was just posing the question as a startup. And then in the audience, we had a lot of people that are of this mindset. We also had 40 students as part of the accelerator program here at the BBB. And everyone goes, yeah, we can. And so I asked the question again, and it just came back louder. And I go, well, I guess our work is done here. This crowd's already kind of figured out. But yeah, there's a lot of people that believe in it and want to see this happen.
So that's a beautiful bridge back to the point I started to make, which is where I'm focusing, what area of activity has got my full attention. And that is exactly young entrepreneurs aspiring builders who are attracted to this challenge of creating a company. This is where the Oyster example is super important as clear evidence.
That's what you need, right? Examples of.
Yeah, and this is not just a company that showed the possibility of the mixing of oil and water. We celebrate that at every scale, right? You know, bakeries, whatever. But for this to happen at venture scale means that if you design impact in, as I'm advocating for, from the very beginning, as big as the business gets, so much bigger gets the impact. I've been leaning in with talks at every MBA program that will give me a mic. Recently at IE Business School in Madrid, just last week, for their Blue Torch ceremony, an incredible moment. And The evidence is in the room that the smartest and brightest builders of tomorrow are excited by this idea. And so to them specifically, I think it's become my passion to reach them with the yes, you can message. And in fact, to deliver into their hands, most specifically, a manual for building this way. My book, Impact Unleashed.
Building, right here in front of me.
Building businesses that
love
scale
it.
Positive change. And so that foremost, that is a book for them. Of course, others are welcome to read it. It is bringing some ideas that have been around down from the ivory tower, right, where they need no further echo, into the accessible and into the hands of folks who are balancing other priorities, who have other distractions, who don't want to get distracted by philosophy about capitalism, right, for example. Great stuff. Do consume it. But this is foremost a manual with highly actionable things we did and things that I advocate builders do, specifically so that they can succeed with vision in the venture-funded ecosystem. That's the key thing. Yep. And as excited as the investors are and of one mind across that $1.7 trillion, they're much more fragmented in their approaches to measurement and philosophy about how. And so the book also has an important section, I think, aimed at impact investors about one way to think about solving the big problems of the world as an investor, which is different from how you attack that as an entrepreneur.
Love that. I'd like to back up a hair, though. You, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
What's your why, man? how did you end up deciding to come down this path? Because usually there's something in life that makes you go, wait a minute.
Right.
Or maybe there's another way of doing this.
Right. The light bulb will go off for folks or not at different times of life when you realize, you know, just the brevity of this thing and of the few available ways that you can have, like, quote, you know, personal impact is you realize is through other human beings. One of the most amazing things you can do in a life is just spend a lot of time staring closely at another human being, you know, call that your partner or your wife as I do. But I think just a plug for that, it's amazing to spend decades in close proximity to one other human. Highly advocate for that. But then, you know, there's a whole broad diversity of other kinds of relationships. We don't have kids. And so for me, I've been looking at my impact as a human, as an entrepreneur, as a builder of companies, as a hirer of people into jobs. And so for some time now, let's say, I became most attentive to getting my sense of why from that range of things. Always looking at my impact, whatever my situation was. And the culmination of that, I think, is to co-found a company that I hope has been life-changing for the people that joined us to build it and rewarding in the ways that we promised, which were different from the rewards you might get at a company that was not trying to mix oil and water. So I hope that that has been true. I hope that for the customers whose doors of possibility we were able to open with regard to global talent, that open door has been rewarding to them, and that the people that they've been able to say yes to through our platform were positive in their organizations. And then, as I like to say, there's a fourth ring, three rings of entrepreneurship. Ring one, give yourself a job. Ring two, give a job to others. Ring three, deliver value for customers. Rinse, repeat that, grow as much as possible. But then is a ring four, which is, you know, what impact does the operation and scale of this company have in the world? It's what I talk about in my book, the thing that can be built for by design. And for me, it goes specifically now to telling this story, sharing this example, bringing encouragement to the right people at the right moment in their lives. So that's my why right now.
Love that.
Yeah.
Well, I love the fact that what you're saying is there's a structure to this. And I think what happens too often with something like this, people start, they want to have a meaningful business. They want to do good things. And then they get into the fray and then things start getting all busy. And we get busy being busy, just running the business and all this. And if this wasn't part of the DNA, and it's not in the structure of the business, then it pretty easily can start to slide off to the side. As well as often when business transition in ownership or something or generation changes, things can have a way of changing if it's not really part of the structure of the business. Very important to be able to do that.
Yes. So I like to say about the book that you can do this with, quote, no values required, right? Let's go back to the question, can companies do good and do well? Do we want them to try even, right? And so the people that say no are the loudest voices in the room are the dirty industries that don't want their access to capital constrained in any way. They don't want capital. They don't want dollars or loans with strings, right? Which would become the case. So they're keen to say, get your ESG out of my pension fund and these kinds of messages. That's them. That's them funding that, you know, just so there's no misunderstanding, right? But then there's the common sense business people who are like, well, you know, we're pro capital and we're pro investing and we want we like values, but in this case, if values and profit were to come into conflict, we want profit to win because that's how we see these vehicles, these investments, and we think that's correct. And so then that's fair to them, right? Because you're not going to change the minds of the folks that are funding the propaganda, the polluters, right? So where it's important to try to change minds is to say, hear ya, this works with, again, quote, no values required. This is structural. It doesn't depend on the niceness of the intentions of the founders or anybody else. This endures. This is a way of building. It's mechanical. And given all the pluses that accrue to companies that just do this, that are value creating, you ought to be legitimately more interested in these kinds of investments than less. That's the point. That's what I want to leave them with.
Love that.
Yeah.
So kind of back to one of the keys of doing this kind of work is how do you measure it, make sure, you know, we're actually doing what we say we do and all that. And you guys very early on took on the idea of becoming a B Corp, which is definitely a challenge when you're smaller too. That really, and for folks who should know that on this podcast, what the B Corp organization is, it's really a true monitoring of all the different things that you're saying that you're doing. And it's very difficult to actually get that level of approval and you got to maintain it. So maybe talk a little bit about why did you go down that path? What are the challenges and what has that added to what you guys have been trying to do?
Yeah.
Do you recommend it in the book?
Yeah. There's a whole section about B Corp in the book. I'm a fan of B Corp and what they have done. And my story with B Corp goes back to 2007 in San Francisco, where I happened to be involved with this organization called the Taproot Foundation that was doing great work through a grant mechanism, matching executives who had time to give, like me, to nonprofits who have different kinds of needs. It gave me a chance to lean in and see under the kimono of about 15 locals in San Francisco. One of those I became a board member of for 6 years, which was San Francisco CASA, amazing organization, kind of an accidental nonprofit. That's a whole other conversation, but a fascinating case study who gets capital relative to how important the work they're doing is, right? So go look at them and their specific challenge. But I happened to find myself in a room with J. Barton Andrew close to the first celebration of the first cohort of B Corp companies in Berkeley. And I was immediately attracted to the idea, the approach, right? Because by then I had been exposed enough to nonprofits to see that this is not the way you go after global economic inequality. So I, as a systems thinker, I was already like even subconsciously wondering, these are the machines we have for bringing money and people, talent together to achieve effects, which can include wealth creation and impact. And it's seemingly not in a lot of cases those two things at once. So that's the bulb that is flickering at the time. And so when I heard what B Lab was doing with B Corp, I was immediately attracted to it as a way as a technologist, I recognize it as a standard, right? Standards are important because they help standardize behavior and shift.
You know where the bar is set.
Exactly, exactly. And as a marketer, I was keen to see a label get attached to things. That was cool. Like, I'd already been aware of the importance of third-party validations in the young internet, right? And so this seemed like a digitally progressive approach as well. I appreciate it as a way for companies that were meeting certain criteria to brand and distinguish themselves. And so fast forward many years later, B-Lab has globalized. It's now, you know, many thousands of companies and of various sizes, lots of stories to talk about. You know, I'm winking, of course, at Dr. Bronner's, which might be fun to talk about a little later. So I'm paying attention, and I see that it's becoming a more and more important global brand, that they are achieving what they did, that they are sticking to that mission, even as I'm, you know, observing from a distance. But when it came to the creation of Oyster, it was an obvious, important external validation. Imagine the overly sensitive head of marketing who's looking to get caught in all the ways that he's merely waving his hands. Right. And so that to me seemed a way to do the opposite, which is to lean in, to make commitments, to embrace external standards, invite others into an assessment, not just a look, but an assessment and a grade of what we were doing seemed an important milestone at the earliest stages, which so we commenced that almost immediately. It took longer than expected for us to be certified. And the reason for that is applications have company size buckets, and we were growing so quickly that we kept
changing buckets,
skipping out of the bucket and having to restart the certification. But we were ultimately certified in 23.
Have you found any challenges internal? You say you're a torchbearer for this, right? And say with your co-founder or whatever, I mean, you have to find yourself at some level making the sales pitch of here's why we should do this.
Well, here's an example of how installing that commitment of mixing oil and water from the very beginning changes everything, because it attracted certain people who were not cynical, but rather credulous and inspired by what we were attempting to do to join the organization. When the distraction, let's call it, to some extent, of applying and certifying, it was work for not just myself, but other people throughout the organization who were involved. There was, you know, to a person, absolute commitment and excitement for that. It's the right people already being on board, because the big idea was already in place before.
So when you get hired there, you know, right. this is part of why you're signing up is because
rather than you know, rather than the CEO meets someone from B-Lab over a weekend and has nice drinks and decides to become a B-Lab on Monday. Different, right? Those considerations arrive and into what organizational context is everything. So again, blank sheet of paper is absolutely the best place to start, back to, you know, why I'm so focused on people who are inspired by the opportunity to build that way from scratch.
I think there's something you said about that when it's already in the foundation, and that's actually you drawing people to that concept versus trying to sell people on it afterwards.
Later,
when the guest that we had on here was from a company called Interface. They basically make these carpeting squares, which was an oil-based, really dirty product. Big company, a publicly traded company. And the CEO got religion about what was happening. And so all of a sudden he wanted to make the big shift. And it's a great, they have a documentary on this. And it was great because the leadership it actually took and his driving to maintain this, because the CFO's going, what the hell are you doing, man? This is crazy. And I guess all the board members are calling saying, hey, it's Jack okay? You know, it's like this kind of thing. So, trying to bring it in later is always a little more difficult.
Very hard, but can be done.
Of course it can be done. Yeah. Again, back to the leadership. This is something we believe
exactly,
in. It's true.
And even if you have a room that you fill of people that were brought in for idea one, doesn't mean they can't be excited and fired up, you know, to 11, you know, by idea six.
You know? But it also goes back to what you were saying in the very beginning. When you go out and poll people and say, hey, what kind of product do you want to buy? I want to buy these kind of products that are good in the environment. Well, the same thing. What kind of company do you want to work for?
Exactly. One of the other things to talk about is like the corporate monster. And so meanwhile, Right. Here I am excited to talk about companies at inception and stuff and to try to get as many companies as possible to think this way. Meanwhile, we're in a Japanese monster movie here with the runaway powers of corporation in America relative to consumers and their employees and other people. And so, and I have a fresh perspective from just getting back from Europe and seeing how excited they are. How come we don't have as many unicorns, or how come we don't have as many trillion-dollar companies over here? It's not for small GDP, certainly, here at all. What are we doing wrong? And so very, very interesting discussion with some really smart people, including the former prime minister of Italy. So I was literally in a lawn chat with these guys in Madrid last week. And as I'm hearing them say things, and one of those things we have to get out of the way is the regulatory stuff, right? So I'm like, how interesting. The other side of the fence, right, rushing towards something that is already biting us in the ass here, let's say. And so you can't talk about any of this. You can't talk about mobilizing companies for impact without observing that the monster is out of control. The idea is not to be anti-growth or anti-capitalistic, but let's revisit some of those historical boundaries that were there to protect consumers and were there to protect employees. And I'll stop there. I think since the pandemic, companies who are very profitable have been behaving very opportunistically.
It was kind of funny post-COVID when employees all of a sudden had a little say in the matter. And then that control seems to have gone back the other way now. Don't worry, guys. We got it covered. AI's got your job, so don't be pushing back on things.
Yeah, so there was a promising moment of collective voice, let's call it, if not power. Like if not power, voice, certainly. I'm sure we'll hear from it again.
Something will happen. I don't know, one of my things is, and the reason I do the work I do, way early in my career, I just saw this where people just showing up trading time for money. And I thought, man, work should be something you really enjoy. You get to come and express your gifts and do these kinds of good things. Kumbaya, take the hill, it's a team. And I realized, no, this is a bunch of people running some lifelong marathon, just grinding their way through life. And I go, that just doesn't seem right. And that's where I found purpose, be it working on a project or for the company, became sort of this thing that people could rally around. And if you can connect your strengths and your purpose to what that company's doing, then powerful things would happen. It's a win-win-win. I think I saw a statistic that you guys, employee engagement in your business is like 71%. The flip side is in the world, it's 71% the other way. So yeah. Good job there.
Yeah. Whatever your business is, can't say enough to opening your doors to geographically diverse people. Sure, there's an economic argument there, and no one is saying let's pretend there isn't, but it's not the full picture. As you're suggesting, Jeff, there can be transformational positives for your organization.
Maybe a whole new view of the world might change your product line.
When you do, as we did in our case, which is put mission alignment as the top criteria, starts there, then qualified for the job. When you start there, which is not something that you could do practically if you were trying to hire within a radius of miles around an office. So yeah, plug for globally distributed teams, 100%.
Love that. So you're a guy, you were just mentioning spending a little time in Europe. You're out here seeing the world. What are you excited about? I mean, there's lots of things to be concerned about. Obviously, we got the war that maybe we put on pause here, hopefully. What excites you? What are you seeing that could inspire all of us, Jack?
Yeah, so it's tough to even let a question like that flash through your mind without coming inescapably to the letters A and I. You have to start with a position of sensitivity and empathy and compassion for the many different communities and trades, let's say. It feels like a kind of a doomsday when you have spent decades of your life getting a sense of fulfillment and a sense of identity from a certain kind of work, and to even just have to suffer the threat. People would argue, well, that's not actually going to happen and blah, blah, blah. It matters about as much as the threat of the big one mattered to Penelope in Indiana in the 50s, who was legitimately anxious and paranoid and under her bed from the things that were reaching her ears at that time about possible futures, which is not to dismiss what's happening right now. It's just another example of that, and that people will look back and it'll feel like a charming thing. I'm not saying that at all, But I do want to signal it as a sense of we have survived these kinds of feelings collectively in the past. So I think to the existential dread, whether that's in relation to employment or it's just the world not being the way it's supposed to be or breaking in some significant way or something incalculably terrible happening, I think first thing is whatever you say, you have to first nod over in that direction. I end that on a positive note with we've survived this before. We've had technological revolution of our work, of our very civilization. At times, dramatically fast. I mean, look at even just this decade, which we're only in the sixth year.
It's been wild.
My God, right? And so I do take comfort in we're still here. We've survived things that felt really as portentous of something terrible happening imminently before. So I draw comfort from that historical pattern of us surviving these kinds of fast transformations. To comment just a little bit more on transformation in the workforce, I think that there's a glibness around the idea that, well, you know, new jobs will get made and those, yes, will go away, right? It's a logic we've seen before and we understand it. But I just want to say to those people that are maybe being a little glib in those descriptions, this is broader and faster than anything we have seen before and made scary by the fact that a lot of executives at big companies are overreacting or reacting in the wrong ways with regard to personnel choices. The AI alibi in laying off people where there's no real plan. It's more evidence of the corporate monster, right? There's plenty of cause for anxiety if you're someone who is at a job that feels, even a knowledge work job that feels under threat. To those, I would say there is also tremendous opportunity. I know that it may be hard to muster enthusiasm against a feeling in a background of doom, but if ever there was a window for fast professional transformation, don't poo-poo AI, dive in, show yourself capable, build things. It's incredible. This is the way rather than to just, you know, I mean, what's the alternative?
Resisting's not going
to
work.
Right, exactly. Poo-pooing all the way to the pink slip. So I would say it's a window where you spent 20 or 30 years doing can suddenly dramatically be recharacterized in light of this new opportunity. That's once in a lifetime. And so even if you think like, well, not me, or yeah, I mean, give it a shot. It truly is that universally empowering from a, you know, taking something from an idea to a prototype standpoint. Just over the last couple of days, I had a conversation over LinkedIn with a young entry-level graduate who is looking for work in HR. And I said, hey, you know, like, have you tried like things like Lovable and using Claude as like a product manager to write your prompts? And she got back in like a half a day and said she'd built something and said that completely recharacterized the way she can start conversations with prospective employers, not as a, hey, I'm this resume of capabilities, but look what was in my mind that I can show you now that shows my depth of understanding of workflows that I, you know, as in her case, have never worked on, but understand deeply. But in the case of someone who has like a deep knowledge in the legal profession or, you know, in some other, or design or business development, I would say you have a window here to reinvent your careers if you want to. Don't miss it. But ultimately, I'm most excited that we legitimately could cure cancer in a year or like extend
some amazing things
extend
happen, yeah.
Health span by 50%, right? I mean, so therein is the, you know, is the yin and yang of the terror and the promise, right? My imaginations have gone mainly to the positive things that are for me sources of inspiration and hope. It's weird out there, weird for these big companies, weird for governments. We're seeing some unprecedented behaviors in response to what is obviously some need for control of this stuff. On the global arena, fascinating, fascinating stuff is happening.
Well, one of the things I keep thinking about is what this means to leadership, that this is a big leadership issue. And I think too often people aren't looking at the role as leaders of how am I going to manage my team, my people through this scenario. And so, yeah, it's one of the areas I'm focusing on. Got one other quick question for you. You have to be from San Diego to be on the podcast. That's part of the deal here.
Does La Mesa count?
La Mesa counts, of course.
All right.
So you've been here for, what, a couple of years, I think you just told me now?
Yeah, we moved in November of 21.
What's the one thing that you've said, wow, didn't expect that, moving to San Diego?
Oh, that's a great question. This is also something that I'm legitimately excited about because it's kind of unplanned and exciting. So back in San Francisco in 2008 or so, there was a certain vibe at events where people would come out and you would see the energy, people were showing up, and it was just this obvious ecosystem that was just happening very organically that included founders, builders, people who wanted to look for co-founders, investors, and early brands who wanted to be in that mix from a local standpoint, either by hosting events or showing up, etc. And so there was something amazing that would, from which so much change in the world would come, that was happening in San Francisco at that point of convergence. And I recognized a similar energy when I started to just show up to some of these very organic looking meetups, mixers for like startup, like, you know, it just had the word startup. What does that even mean? One of the consequences for me of moving here, although I'm, you know, generally delighted, I don't have a lot of conversational opportunity, let's say, or it's become scarcer for me. It seems fewer people are interested in building companies and this kind of stuff. I started to just go for social reasons because I was keen to just kind of find people to talk to about companies and ideas and funding and things like that. My realization these years in is that something amazing is happening in San Diego. And I think for obvious reasons, there's been a thing here for a while. There's been an ecosystem here of biotech and military tech and folks writing checks into those industries. And we've had a lot of folks like me move to San Diego because it's amazing, who are keen to do something at a local level, be involved, bring energy, bring capital. And so there seems to be an incredible moment of convergence in that regard that I recognize the energy of from that San Francisco memory. And I'm really, really excited about that.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I moved here, I guess, about 11 years ago now. My wife and I are from Orange County. Felt like we came here for a reason, not just to be here.
Yeah.
And it truly is. I just love San Diego. There's an energy. It's the kind of the big, small city kind of thing. We got all the parts and pieces. And I think we can be a beacon on the hill here. So yeah, I think that's very exciting.
And we have this post-pandemic city identity thing happening, which is places are getting chosen, right? And people are coming here. And that, I think, is more determinative than...
Bad for the cost of real estate, but other than that...
Yeah, but it depends, you know, which side of the equation you're on.
Exactly.
It could be good for the cost of
depending
real
on where you sit in the program.
Yeah, exactly. But you can't ignore the influx, right? And the folks who know how to build and who are keen and who are okay to foster ecosystem in ambiguity. I think that's exciting.
And we've got a great community here represented by all of our collaborators with the podcast, trying to build that kind of community you're talking about. You know, people are doing business and doing it well. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to put some icing on the San Diego cake, I've spoken a little bit about this with my good friend Abraham Chen, who's the new executive director of Be Local here in San Diego. Shout out.
If you'd like to know more, he's been on the podcast, so look him up.
Shout out to Abe and his good work. And a point of alignment is that he sees that there's an opportunity not just to be an ecosystem where companies are being spawned, but that here particularly that companies that are doing good and well will be spawned. That is an idea that is close to Abe's heart. And it makes a lot of sense that should be an aspect of what is happening here. It's more than just let's also be an ecosystem, right? It's let's be an ecosystem with this specific focus of generating impactful, do good and do well companies.
Yep,
that's us. That's a powerful, powerful calling and opportunity.
We can be that here in San Diego. Well, time to put a bow on this, Jack. I always like to end with what's the one big idea? One thing you want people to walk away and definitely remember.
There are opportunities for life-changing experiences in every day. I'm not full of shit when I say I just try to bring my open heart and my honesty to every moment that I have with everyone that I meet, and it seems to continue to surprise me and change my life. So walk out there, have engagements, share your energy, watch what happens.
See what happens. Love that. That's awesome. Well, Jack, I appreciate you coming in the studio today and doing the podcast. You've done some amazing things in the world, and you're going to continue to do those, and we're glad to have you here in San Diego to help us move this thing forward.
So, thank you, brother. Deeply honored to be here with you.
That's our show for today, and if you enjoyed it, please subscribe, comment, and most importantly, share the podcast with a friend. Again, special thanks to our collaborative community of San Diego business organizations, the Better Business Bureau, Conscious Capitalism, Be Local, and Cause San Diego. We're all using the influence of business to positively impact our very own community of San Diego. I'm Jeff Blanton from Jailbreak Leadership saying until next time, go do what you do. Go do what you do best, where we're all counting on you.